Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav, the multiple winners on the PGA Tour this season: Scottie Scheffler, Roy McIlroy, Ryan Fox, Sepp Straka, Ben Griffin, and yes, Brian Campbell. Rex, can you believe it? He prevailed in a one-hole playoff. Thankfully, this one did not go five holes against Emiliano Grillo to win the John Deere Classic. Your thoughts, please, from 6,500 miles away in Scotland.
Staying in Edinburgh. We flew over a couple days early to do some sightseeing around Edinburgh. We're staying in Residence Inn. Beautiful little spot. It's cold. It's raining. Just so you're packing to come over in a few days. So just so you know that. It's not just that he's a two-time winner, Brian Campbell. It's that he's done them both in playoffs. I mean, this is maximum pressure, and he doesn't seem to get impacted by it all. He looked confident. He looked relaxed. He did not look like a player who was scrambling on a Sunday afternoon. Even when things got tough, you look at what happened to him on 14. That was a really bad drive. He had to pull off a really difficult shot from the fairway bunker. Couldn't quite do it, but he was able to get up and down. You look at the way he sort of rebounded from 15. That was an awful drive. Just sniped it left of left. Didn't even go looking for it down in the woods. Makes a double bogey, but still never really feels like he's out of it. He just keeps grinding away and makes a birdie on 17 to essentially force the playoff. It's been impressive for a player that, let's be honest, you and I probably have never mentioned Brian Campbell on this podcast in 10 plus years of doing it. Now, seven of those years, he lost his tour card and he was a little bit adrift, which speaks to his resilience. But I do like the idea of a player like this, and I don't particularly want to compare him to Ben Griffin because I think Ben has been a little bit more consistent than Brian has on this particular front, but this victory does get Brian into the top 30 on the U.S. Ryder Cup point standings.
And we're picking Brian Campbell for Bethpage.
I think you jumped ahead a couple of steps on that one. I just pointed out that it gets him inside the top 30 with a couple of big events coming up that he can certainly. The one part that I would say is his consistency just isn't there. After that playoff over Potgieter, who just won last week, I think we labeled Potgieter a true phenomenon. That was a playoff victory. He hasn't had a top 10 finish since then. As a matter of fact, he missed more cuts, missed more weekends than he's played more since then. So it's not as though he's gone out and done what Ben Griffin has done or Sepp Straka and turned himself into this world-class player that seems to be in and about the lead week in and week out. But when you see how he plays, and it's not the modern game, I think you pointed out you actually have a faster ball speed with your driver than he has, which is the most humblest of brags. And I will say that the signature shot that he hit on Sunday was on 17, the par five, the second shot. That was a 277-yard shot to like 18 feet for a pretty easy two-putt birdie. Do you know what his driving average was for the week off the tee? 270 yards. No, it was 270 yards. So he actually hit that three wood off the deck longer than he was averaging off the tee. So he's not the prototype of the modern professional. It's not like he's going out overpowering golf courses like we saw Potgieter last week, but he's pretty impressive when his game is on.
I mean, this is why I love covering professional golf, because over the past 2 weeks, I'm not sure that you could have a more stark dichotomy in two players who both won on the PGA Tour. They just so happened to be in the playoff at the Mexico Open. But Aldrich Potgieter, 2 weeks ago at the Rocket Classic, we're talking about a guy with 195 mile an hour cruising ball speed, a guy who hits at 330, a guy who's 20 years old and seemingly has a limitless future. You know, major championships, you know, he could be a President's Cup stalwart, you know, a potential top 10 player in the world. All of it is on the table for someone like him. Fast forward 1 week, and the player who he lost to, the Mexico Open player, Brian Griffin, wins the John Deere Classic. He was last among those who made the cut in driving distance. You mentioned the 164 mile an hour ball speed with his tee shot on 18 in regulation in the playoff. He has 108 mile an hour club head speed. And anyone who follows me on Instagram and sees my club head speed, you know that I swing a whole lot harder than that and spray it everywhere. You mentioned not having a top 10 finish since the Mexico. He hasn't had a top 30 finish since Mexico. Even with a win, he was still 58th in the FedEx Cup playoffs and not yet sort of secured his spot in the playoffs, which just start in a couple weeks time. Like, that's really, really hard to do. And yet I can't be more impressed or have more respect for him as a player, because he has to know that the tide is washing up against him. He has to know that there are just more and more Aldrich Potgieters coming down the pipeline, and it is going to be incredibly hard for him to keep his playing privileges on the PGA Tour for the years to come. And yet now he has 2 years again of security He just showed that he could beat the strongest field that they've had, the John Deere, ever in the OWGR era. Like, you just have to have respect for a player who doesn't have all of the physical capabilities and all of the physical tools, but he has belief in himself. He has timeliness, and he certainly has clutch putting, which was evident on Sunday at the John Deere Classic.
And I was impressed. We talked a little bit over Sunday and into the earlier in the week about the idea of his resilience. I think it was 10 years ago that he essentially started his PGA Tour career at the John Deere Classic, playing as an amateur on an exemption. And then everything that he's been through in that ride. And we were listening to his post-round interview, and he was asked specifically about, would you have done anything different? And I think you had a really good, simple response. Don't get hurt. Just stay healthy would have been the easiest part. But
I mean, he was a great college player. He was a great amateur player. He flashed on the PGA Tour quickly. And then, as you mentioned, got adrift, injuries, was just struggling just to keep his car in the Korn Ferry Tour before he eventually made it back to the big circuit.
And we talked about this last week with Potgieter, the idea that he's a phenom, not just because of what he can do with the golf ball off the tee, not just because of that prodigious power that he has off the tee. It's because there's so many other areas that you know he can improve on. His short game, his putting, all of the things that we're seeing him get better at on almost a weekly basis. Whereas if you're a Brian Campbell, at this stage in your career, you almost feel like you're maxed out. And so this is what you bring to the table. It's not as though you're going back to the drawing board on every off week trying to get that 1% better. You don't really have that option. I will say it is impressive watching him play that brand of golf on the modern PGA Tour, because we just don't see it very often. It's just not something. I go back to the days when early in my career when I covered it, and you had a Gavin Coles type player who really couldn't hit it out of his shadow, but he kept his tour card for the better part of almost a decade. And you realize how difficult that was, because every part of your game has to be on. You don't have the luxury of not being able to. I didn't chip well this week, but I still finished well. I didn't putt well this week, but I still finished well. To your point about what he had done in between Mexico, that playoff victory, and this week, this second victory only moved him up to 29th on the FedEx Cup points list. So he's still not guaranteed to make it to East Lake, even with two wins.
And we're going to have a punch out later in the program. It is going to be very lucrative if you can make it to East Lake, and particularly waves at the FedEx Cup playoffs. Stay tuned for that one. Rex, there's just 4 weeks remaining in the PGA Tour regular season. So I thought in that respect that John Deere sort of accomplished what it was supposed to, that these are the players who are fighting for their competitive livelihoods, particularly after the PGA Tour sort of shifted the goalposts from top 125 to top 100. Keeping their eligibility for 2026. And so you had Emiliano Grilli, who began the week just outside the top 100, losing in the playoff. Now he's safely inside the number, projected 64th. You had a player like Kevin Roy as well, David Lipsky, Carson Young, Matt Kuchar, Kurt Kitayama, even Max Homa getting inside the number. Were you satisfied? I know the big names besides Max Homa didn't really show up on the weekend. But if you're the PGA Tour and you're trying to build these tournaments as sort of the last, you know, sort of the last dance for a lot of these players to keep their cards, do you think that it was a successful week in that respect?
I think so, because there's a function on the PGA Tour scoring app where you can kind of go. It's called the bubble watch. So right now it's top 100 and top 70. And I think three players played their way in and three players played their way out of that magical top 100 number, Emiliano Grilli being one of them. He was 105th coming into this week. All you want to see is volatility. Yes, you'd like for it to be a big name like a Max Homa. And we're going to talk about Max in a minute. I think he's going to be disappointed that he didn't play very well, especially on Sunday. But he has to be happy with what he was able to do with himself on that front, where he was well on the outside of trying to crack that top 100 and essentially just keeping his job for next year. So this will go a long ways. We brought this up a few weeks ago, I think, when we were talking about getting into this final stretch of the season. I think it will be compelling for an element of the audience. You have to be a golf fan to want to pay attention to this. Everything else is probably just numbers that people kind of, your average golf fan, are probably just going to gloss over, because it doesn't really resonate. It doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot unless you get a story like a Brian Campbell today, where you can go back the last 10 years and point out that this is where things went wrong, and this is where he tried to start. This is where things started to go right again, and you start building yourself to it. I like it. I'm sure you do too, because it gives us content, gives us something to watch, gives us something to talk about. And I think there's an element there, storytelling, that if you do it right, and I think CBS did a good job this week and last week of sort of pointing out the guys who are on the bubble and what they're playing for week in and week out. I don't think you can inundate people with that type of information. I don't think you can do it on every single shot, but if it's done correctly and done in a way that tells a story, I think it is compelling for a certain element of the audience.
Yeah, I think it has to be a balance. And I think the John Deere's of the world are the perfect antidote to golf fans, the diehard golf fans who may have been turned off by sort of the signature event series and the PGA Tour's pandering to the biggest stars and making sure those guys are paid and making sure they have the best chances to win and making sure that they're in the proper TV windows and making sure with no cuts that they're going to be around for all the fans on the weekend. Like that is clearly star driven. And I think there's certainly obviously a segment of the golf population that likes to watch that. And I think the TV ratings for the signature events in particular on the PGA Tour have been really strong this year. And I think the PGA Tour would view them as a success, but that would get really old really quickly. And I think that's one of the criticisms of LIV Golf, right? Where it's 54 players and you're seeing them week in and week out, 14 times a year, the field sizes don't fluctuate. And it just grows tired that way. You need to have an infusion of these types of tournaments, these types of storylines, this types of drama and significance. There's still something special about trying to keep your place among the very best teams or the very best leagues or the very best players. You know, I think that's what, if you're a fan of the NBA or the NFL, I'm a big Jacksonville Jaguars fan. The Jags were terrible each of the last 2 years. That's really hard to watch. And late in the season, there's not much to watch, right? You know, at that point, you're actually hoping that they lose so you can get a better draft pick. In the PGA Tour, there really is no tanking. You just have a bunch of players who, like we saw battling out on Sunday, who have been sort of floundering this season. Whether it's Emiliano Grillo, he didn't have a top 10 this year. Whether it's David Lipsky, who just missed out on the playoffs. He's 165th in the FedEx Cup standings, looking like he's going to drop all the way to sort of limited status on the Korn Ferry Tour at this rate. And so to have them battling out for significant tournaments, for significant prizes, I think is a huge appeal for the PGA Tour, because at this point, it's still the preeminent golf circuit in the world. And even though these players might not be having a great season, trying to stay there, trying to stay at that level, to me is compelling drama, even if it doesn't have potentially some of the marquee names.
And even more so because they've moved the goalpost, and we've talked about this a little bit, the idea that they moved the number from 125 to 100. We're going to have a player who finishes 110 and probably feels like they had a decent season compared to what they had done over the majority of their career, and they're going to be on the outside. They're going to have limited status. But I love the idea, and we talk about this all the time when it comes to the Premier League, and the relegation of those teams is something that's very compelling. Like, those are storylines I think that even your average fans don't spend a lot of time paying attention to. You don't get that in the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA. If a player is not up to a standard, he's probably going to lose his contract, but there's no hard line where you say this player's out, that player's in, depending on how you played over the course of the season. Golf has always had this. So it always is fun. I used to say Q School was one of my most enjoyable events to cover because you had that hard line and it was six rounds and you didn't necessarily have to gravitate towards the star player in that field. I remember the year that Dustin Johnson earned his tour card at Orange County National. I didn't write about Dustin Johnson. I wrote about Michael Allen, who had tried to qualify for the PGA Tour 20 straight years and finally broke through. Those are the stories, I think, for those specific events and to a certain degree, this event, the John Deere Classic, that's what they can hang their hat on.
This is probably an awkward segue then, because Max Homa, who seemingly under normal circumstances would be fighting for his competitive livelihood and said he's exempt on the PGA Tour through 2028 because of its various lifelines, was the, I would call him the protagonist at the John Deere Classic, a player who did not have a top 10 finish this season, has not done much of anything other than a surprisingly good performance at the Masters earlier this year. Doesn't even have a top 10 rex on the PGA Tour since May 2024. Max Homa very much in the mix, shot 69 in the final round, ended up in the log jam for fifth. If not for missed putts inside 10 feet on 17 and 18, absolutely could have been a part of that playoff. Did you see this week coming for Max Homa? And if not, what do you think it can do for him?
I did not see this week coming, not just because of his putting, but his ball striking.
I don't think Max Homa saw this week coming.
I don't think so either. I wanted to point out two things. One, earlier in the week, he kind of made some headlines. And to be fair to Max, when we ask a player a question, very few answer as well as Max does. And he actually put some thought into it, wants to give you a decent answer. And he was asked something along the lines of, why aren't you on social media anymore? And he made the revelation that social media is a garbage fire of mean people. And he's 100% true. Like, I know that's not a revelation to any of us. It's a little disingenuous. And he has said this before, that he always seems to fall back on that based on the fact that social media, Twitter, X, pretty much made his career or made his personality, made his brand. I think his play on the course brought it to a new level. But before he was winning, he was a social media star. And so I do feel like
for roasting people, in other words, being mean.
Well, yes. And he did it in a very fun way. He would go after swings and things like that. But he was part of that cesspool that is the garbage fire of mean people on social media. So I do always roll my eyes to throw the emoji out there just since we're talking about social media. I will say it was a bigger week, though, for Max for the reasons we just pointed out. 122nd on the points list. I mean, you're way on the outside. He's not in the field next week at the Scottish Open. He's not in the field at the Open Championship. So he's running out of time really, really fast. He needed this one just to give him some sort of boost going into whatever's left of the season for him. And I will say, to your point, who saw this coming? Probably not Max, but he had an answer earlier in the week to a question about how is this time different? These struggles different than the last time you went through this, 2016, 2017, sort of that time frame when he lost his tour card, kind of hit rock bottom in a very similar way. He said this time is different because he feels like he's much, much closer this time around. He said last time it felt like I couldn't do anything right, that I was just floundering, that I had no chance whatsoever. This time it feels like when he shows up, he at least has an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, game-wise, I was on Golf Today last week. We did one of those CDW like stats segments, and it involved Max Homa, and we were going through sort of what he is doing now sort of through the bag comparative 2 or 3 years ago, when I would call him a star on the PGA Tour, a perennial winner. He looked like he was gonna be on a cup team for a long time. The stark difference from Max Homa in 2025 to Max Homa in 2021 is crazy. Like, we're talking 3.5 shots in terms of a scoring average, and just off the tee, approaching the green, around the green, putting. It was markedly bad. Like, he's not hitting as many fairways, and so now he's not hitting as many greens. And when he does miss greens, his short game's not as sharp. And, oh, yeah, when he actually gets on the green, he's not making many putts inside 10 feet. And so he's making a lot of bogeys, and consequently, he's also not making many birdies. Like, he was just sort of floundering. And I think when you look, like, at Sunday in particular, he obviously had a poor day, you know, with the putter, but he hit just 5 fairways. That was the fewest of any player who made the cut. He had driven it beautifully for 3 days. So I think there will still be a lot of positives to draw on. But I go back. I think what you actually saw from Max Homa on Wednesday in his press conference is a better window into his soul than whatever he said with the media on Sunday night. Like, that's as candid of a pre-tournament press conference as you're ever going to find, where Max Homa said, the day before the tournament started, that pieces of his game feel awesome, but he's not sharp. You know, anyone can get hot for 4 days. Hopefully that's me. Ended up being him for at least 3.5 days. He said that Max Homa did that. He can't wait for the season to be done so that he can begin to unwind. He said, to your point about social media, that he can't wait. Go out to sports bars anymore because fans will either come up to him, fans will say something to him. It's just not a pleasant experience anymore because of all of the, quote, angry a-holes. And so I was reminded watching the press conference, and we watched it live. I was reminded of the line that everyone wants to be rich, but no one wants to be famous. And I think that probably says a lot for a lot of PGA Tour players, where a Tiger Woods or a Roy McIlroy, who have lived their lives in fish bowls, and now in sort of the social media era, and Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth and Max Homa have all risen to promise. Risen to promise. It can't be easy for these guys to live that life, particularly when you're struggling as he has. Because Jordan Spieth, for all his struggles, Justin Thomas, for all of his relative struggles, they didn't quite have the amount of despair that Max Homa seems to bring to tournament weeks, including when he's working on his game at home as well.
No, and that's a really good point. I think Max probably speaks for a lot of tour players in that situation. I would imagine Rory McIlroy has had similar thoughts over the last few weeks that, yes, I like to be successful. I don't particularly like being famous. So I can see how he's in a difficult position. Probably needs a break away from the game, but he's got a lot to do between now and then.
Yeah, he certainly does. Just inside the top 100 in FedEx Cup points. Well, Rex, earlier this week, we had a chance to catch up with our friend and yours, Jamie Weir of Sky Sports, to talk all things Scottish Open and the Open Championship. That conversation coming up after this short break. And for this Boots on the Ground segment, we are pleased to be joined by Jamie Weir of Sky Sports. And Jamie, before we get into the Scottish Open, the Open Championship, and the Ryder Cup, I want to talk a little bit about final qualifying for the Open, which wrapped up earlier this week at four sites around the UK. What stories sort of resonated with you most?
I think the standout story has to be Lee Westwood qualifying at Dundalk. Link's just remarkable, 52 years of age, to have the hunger to still turn up and, you know, mix it with all the other guys who are trying to play 36 holes in a day just for that chance to get to the Open Championship. You know, he's knocked on the door, obviously, so many times in Opens. Lee Westwood, he's been so close to getting his hands on that elusive claret jug, hasn't quite managed it. Could he do it? What a romantic story it would be if he was to do it at this stage of his career. But I think just show the willingness to go and roll your sleeves up and get involved in FQ like he did, and qualifying, top qualifying at Dundonald this week. That was obviously the standout story. Some other great stories around as well. The Estonian kid, 20 years of age. You know, I think there's 9 golf courses in Estonia or something like that. And he's, I think, won pretty much at every one, you know, events at every one of them. Comes over at West Lancs, double bogeys his 36th hole of the day to fall into a playoff, and then holds his second shot from the fairway in that playoff. Cue chaotic scenes. So Richard Tedder will be playing in his first Open Championship as well. And where I was at Royal Cinque Ports, and we didn't get the sort of, you know, really romantic stories that, or the sort of big names, I think, that maybe people might have been hoping for. Graham McDowell was playing there. And obviously the Open Championship is not just in Graham McDowell's home country this year, but it's in his hometown. So it would have meant something very special to GMAC to get to Portrush. That wasn't quite to be. We had both Poulters, father and son, trying to qualify at Royal Cinque Ports as well. And Luke, who, as you guys will know, is a sort of rising amateur star in the game, had a wonderful round in the morning, 5 under par. Unfortunately, just the wind picked up in the afternoon and the wheels slightly came off for him, sadly, because it would have been great to see him play in his first Open. I'm sure he will play in many. And his dad also was 1 under par for his 36 holes, Ian Poulter, for the day as well. So neither of them made it, sadly, which would have been a great story. But where I was, you had somebody like Nathan Kimsey, who has been a pro for 12 years, a name that many people might not necessarily know, but has never played in a major. He's now heading to his first major championship. And his girlfriend is also a professional golfer and won the British Amateur at Royal Portrush 14 years ago. So wonderful little stories like that. And Seb Cave, who's an amateur, Curtis Knipes, who is playing in only his second ever major, and his first major was 6 years ago at Royal Portrush when he was the youngest man in the field. And he's been through it all since then. He's sunk to the very lowest parts of the game and considered giving it all up, but now he's heading back to the Open. So it's all the little stories you get like that from Open qualifying, which are just fantastic. And it's the same, as you guys know, for, you know, US Open qualifying. It's all these wonderful little nuggets that we get throughout the day. So yeah, it was a tremendous day down in the south coast in Deal on Tuesday, in glorious sunshine, as we've had here in the south of England where I live for the last 5 weeks now. It's just been we haven't had a drop of rain in weeks, and I'm assuming it's probably the same up at Royal Portrush and at Renaissance where we're going to be next week. But my garden is completely yellow. There's been no rain here at all. The weather's been glorious. And as you can see, I'm brown as a berry as well.
See, that's good news, though. Brown and I'm bouncy, yellow. That's what we want, right? When we go to the Scottish Open.
From an
Open
Championship point of view, yeah, absolutely. We want it to be firm and fast and fiery for them, don't we?
Going back to final qualifying, the idea that 3 out of the 4 qualifiers were won by players from LIV. What do you think that says about that tour?
It just says that there's tremendously good players on LIV. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody at all. You know, they've got some very competitive golfers over there, and, you know, this is their route into getting into the majors. Obviously, there are now other avenues open to them, and Sergio Garcia got a spot in the Open by getting the one available spot on LIV, and many of them obviously have eligibility through being major champions. But I think it's great that the other guys, this is actually the first time in, I think, 3 years that the likes of Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter have tried to qualify in FQ. And I think it says something about them that they're still willing to do that at that stage of their career. So yeah, I've seen people talk about that over the last couple of days. Oh, what does it say about LIV? It says what we already knew about LIV, which is that there's some really good golfers playing on LIV, and fair play for them you know, between playing in Dallas last week and Valderrama next week, to want to come over and mix it up and play 36 holes in a day and get to Port Rush.
Jamie, Rex is going to be joining you next week at the Scottish Open. I'll be seeing you at Royal Portrush for the Open Championship. What do you think makes this part of the golfing calendar so special?
This part of the year for me is just so special. You know, my kids are breaking up for school tomorrow. And as I said, the sun has been shining here for 5-6 weeks straight. Wimbledon's on at the moment. Test cricket is on at the moment. I know that means nothing to the vast majority of your audience. But just this time of the year, the late evenings, the sun shining, you can go out for a round of golf at, you know, 7 o'clock at night and still get 18 holes in, 8 o'clock at night and still get 18 holes in. So I just love this part of the year. And from a golfing point of view, I think so many of the European golfers who are obviously plying their trade and most of them living in the States, they love getting back over here for this time of the year. They love that run up to the Open Championship, the Scottish Open, which we'll get into it, I'm sure, but I would love to see it a proper traditional Scottish links golf course. It's at Renaissance, fine, but they love getting over for that. Then we head into the Open Championship. And I think there's just something about the height of British summer, the sights, the sounds, the smells of being at an Open Championship. I love it. It's my favorite week of the year, being at the Open. And this year, being in my own little country, is going to be extra special.
Well, and I'll get straight to the Scottish Open right now. It's become one of the more popular stops on the PGA Tour simply because it gives players sort of that extra week to assimilate, to acclimatize themselves, being over in the UK, getting ready for the Open Championship. But you touched on it. Why can't they go to a more traditional links course?
Money is the very quick answer. You know, Renaissance pay to have it there. And, you know, Renaissance, I suppose, is a links golf course. That's certainly how they would sort of sell themselves as a links golf course. It's not a links golf course in the same sense as courses like we see on the open road to like Muirfield or Carnoustie or wonderful courses like North Berwick or Gullen. It's not like that, but it does prepare you, I suppose, for links turf. But it's been there 6 years now, and it's been a co-sanctioned event for the last 3 years. And one thing you have to say is it produces great champions, and it produces, you know, some real drama down the stretch. We had Bob McIntyre winning last year, which was just wonderful. And he, you know, obviously had that tournament snatched from his grasp the year before by Rory, that incredible finish, birding the 17th and 18th the previous year. Xander Schauffele won it the first time. It was a co-sanctioned event. So we've had some really huge winners, major champions and major champion in waiting, perhaps in the case of Bob. And it's been at Renaissance for 6 years now, and it's there to stay for the foreseeable. So look, I understand why people would love to see it at more traditional links golf courses in Scotland, especially with how the incredible options you've got to choose from in that country. But it is where it is, and it is still a way for the guys to prepare for Portrush. And I've got no doubt that next week we'll be in for another thrilling tournament, another exciting finish on Sunday, and probably another stellar champion.
Jimmy, you mentioned your little country. It has happened to produce many great golfers, Hall of Fame golfers, generational golfers. How? Why? Why do you think Northern Ireland has become such a hotbed for great golfing talent?
There's the million-dollar question. Why? I don't know. It's just sometimes the stars align and it's just sort of serendipitous. I was actually talking about this literally on Tuesday when I was down at Royal Cinque, because obviously, as I said beforehand, Graham McDowell would have been one of the real sort of special stories there if GMAC had managed to make it. And when you think back to that 2010 US Open at Pebble Beach, which Graham McDowell won, it sort of kickstarted this incredible phase where three of the six majors in that six major stretch were won by people from Northern Ireland, and three different golfers from Northern Ireland. Rory McIlroy winning the US Open a year later, Congressional in 2011, and a month after that, Darren Clarke winning the Open at Royal St. George's. And for three golfers from that tiny little country to all win majors in the space of 13 months, it was just extraordinary. And that helped. That was a catalyst for the Open coming to Northern Ireland. I think without that happening, it might not have happened, or it certainly wouldn't have happened as quickly as it's happened. And there felt a real sort of weight of momentum behind, let's get the Open Championship to Northern Ireland. And as you know, we've got not just one, but two wonderful courses to choose from in Royal Portrush and Royal County Down. And thinking back to 2019, it was just such a magical week. Everybody I spoke to that week, be it media, players, caddies, people from the RNA, they had nothing but praise about Royal Portrush for how beautiful it was, how spectacular it was. And with Turnberry no longer on the open rota, I think it's probably the most picturesque golf course on the open rota. but how warmly they were received, how well how much the whole town, the whole country, the whole community got behind the Open Championship being there. You know, it had been 68 years, 1951, the last time the Open Championship had been in Northern Ireland. So for not just the weeks and months building up to the 2019 Open, but for years building up to the 2019 Open, there was such an excitement about it. And a lot of these courses on the Open Rota, their members aren't that keen on having the Open come to town, to be honest, because they have to hand their course over to the R&A a couple of months in advance, and they don't get to play in it. If they do get to play in it, they're playing off mats, and they're like, oh, do you know what? It's actually a bit of a pain having the Open Championship. At Royal Portrush, they were just so excited about it, to showcase their golf course to the world, to showcase our little country to the world as well. And Northern Ireland continues to emerge from a difficult past, a troubled past. And I think that week, just being having the eyes of the world on us that week, the golfing eyes of the world on us that week, and being able to see just what a special little place it is, what did wonders for Northern Ireland. And it's no surprise that we're back there within 6 years. I haven't answered your question at all, have I? How did we produce so many major champions in such a short space of time? And not just Northern Ireland, because you've got to remember, when it comes to golf, we're one united island. So to have Padraig Harrington win three majors before those guys, to have Shane Lowry come along and win a major since then as well. There's just something in the water. Maybe there's something in the Guinness. Who knows? I think, you know, sport is a huge part of life in Ireland. We tend to have this sort of underdog mentality where, you know, there's this fighting spirit, this grit, call it what you want. But I think it was, in the case of those three guys, G-Mac, Rory and Darren all winning in that 13-month stretch, it was just a kind of perfect storm and the stars aligning. And I certainly think, you know, now every young Irish golfer coming up through the game, I spoke to Padraig Harrington about this just a couple of months ago, having seen what Padraig did, what G-Mac, Rory, Darren and now Shane have done, every young Irish golfer thinks, there's no reason why I can't go and be a major champion as well. If somebody from our little part of the world can do it, there's no reason why I can't do it. So, you know, I think the success those guys have had and the Open Championship being in Northern Ireland has helped now create a new generation of Irish golfers as well. And that's just wonderful to see.
Nailed it. You answered his question. And you answered my question, because I was going to ask how. How was Portrush such an immediate success? You walked through why you thought it was going to be a success as an open venue again after all of those years. But was there any level of surprise that it was almost immediately brought back into the fold? It almost has a spot now, almost like St. Andrews, where you know we're going to be back there every 6-7 years.
Not a huge surprise, to be honest, because I think, as I said, everybody was blown away by it. Like, literally, nobody had one bad word to say about it in 2019. We got four seasons in a day, which is classic, you know, Ireland. We got, you know, beautiful sunshine when Shane shot that 63 on the Saturday, and then it was pretty foil all day on the Sunday. The course just holds up to any links golf course in the world. It is a spectacular golf course. And as I said, you know, in this day and age when you can have wonderful drone shots for TV viewers, there's not many more picturesque golf courses. That white cliffs hole, the back of that fifth green, falling off onto the white sandy beach below it, the Giant's Causeway in the distance. I mean, it just, everything about it is beautiful and romantic. And the warmth of the welcome that Northern Ireland gave all the players that week, I don't think it was any surprise at all that the R&A would try to get there back there as soon as possible. And that is the case. And it feels like just yesterday, 2019, but the world has changed a lot since then. Who could have foreseen what was going to happen just 12 months after that Open Championship? But here we are, 2025, heading back to Little or Northern Ireland and Royal Portrush, and I cannot wait.
Jamie, please hold your phone steady or you're going to give me a seizure. Going back to 2019... a player that you've followed for 20 some odd years now, Roy McIlroy, had the early exit, the miscut, the emotion poured out afterward. Why do you think that he'll be better equipped to handle Portrush and this home game better than he did 6 years ago?
That's a really good question. You know, I think in the weeks building up to Portrush last time, first of all, you know, Rory played a huge part in the Open coming to Northern Ireland, and we've covered that already. So there was such an excitement on his part years out from the Open being in Northern Ireland. For the weeks and the months building up to it, he was asked so many times, what is it going to be like playing an Open in your home country where you've got the course record and blah, blah, blah. And he tried both different tactics. He tried sort of saying, oh my gosh, it would just be the most special thing in the world. It would be incredible. Da, 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 da. And he also tried to playing it down. It's just another golf tournament. You know, I'm just going to turn up there, tee it up on Thursday morning like everybody else and see how I get on. So I think he was almost trying to kid himself into thinking it was no big deal, where it was enormous for him. And then he ended up just making a Horlicks of his very first hole, quadruple bogey up the first, behind the eight ball from the word go. And obviously we all know then he made a great scrap on Friday afternoon to try to make the cut, didn't quite manage it. But I think he's got six more years of experience under his belt since then. As you both have heard Rory speak so many times about throughout his career, one thing that he prides himself on most, I think, is his resilience. And the fact that he, you know, was able to bounce back from that. And then not just, you know, literally months later, he won the FedEx Cup, didn't he, in 2019?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that is the hallmark. I think that was all. That was almost a sort of sliding doors moment, that 2019 Open Championship. He gave a really emotional interview to Tim Barsh at the Sky Kart for us after that, where he was fighting back the tears. In fact, he wasn't fighting back the tears. He was in tears. And that is one of the reasons we love Rory, because he always wears his heart on his sleeve. And you saw just how much it meant to him then. And I think having had six more years of experience under his belt since then, having completed the career Grand Slam with that weight lifted off his shoulders now, I'm sure he'll be incredibly nervous teeing it up on Thursday morning this year as well. But I just think that he is a different person since then. He's a dad. He's matured. He's achieved his lifelong dream. And we've spoken plenty, especially when he didn't seem his usual self at Oakmont. We've spoken plenty about him being disinterested, unmotivated, needing to find his raison d'etre again. I think being in Northern Ireland at an Open Championship with a chance to win your second claret jug, having knocked on the door, especially with that heartbreaking miss at St Andrews 3 years ago, this is something that he cannot wait for. And I think he is mentally far better equipped than he was 6 years ago.
And it's been such a season of extremes for Rory. Obviously, you mentioned winning the career Grand Slam, finally winning the green jacket at the Masters, but it has been a bit indifferent since then. Do you think Port Rush is sort of that tonic that pushes him over the top, that finally allows him to get inspired again, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's exactly what he needs. I think just being back on this side of the pond is exactly what he needs. I think he was finding the grind of having to go back straight into the PGA Tour and you know, find what that... He himself has spoken about this. The reason for getting out of bed in the morning, the reason for spending 4 hours working, grinding in the range, he was really struggling to find why he was doing it all. And I think just being back over here at this time of year, as I said, it's a special time in this part of the world. Being back on Northern Irish soil next week or in a couple of weeks' time, I think will just allow Rory to sort of breathe a sigh of relief and think, all is well with the world again. And I really do think this could be a special week for him. Whether he goes and wins the claret jug, I don't know. Obviously, there's who knows what's going to happen. Who knows? He might be getting the wrong side of the draw. We can't predict what's going to happen over 4 days at Royal Port Rush. But I think just it'll be a mental reset for him and exactly what he needs at exactly the right time.
Jimmy, if you take Rory out of this, which players this week at the Scottish Open are you most keen to watch, sort of with an eye on the Open Championship and potentially being one of the favorites there?
I think there'll always be a lot of attention on Shane going into Port Rush for obvious reasons as the defending champion there, if you like. But I think given what happened to him at the Travelers and given the fact that he was the runner-up at Royal Port Rush 6 years ago, I think there's a lot of goodwill for Tommy Fleetwood. His game just sets up perfectly for Lynx golf. Again, as I said, everybody has to get lucky on being on the right side of the draw, if there is indeed a right side of the draw. But just if Tommy can just get off to a good start, I think it would be an incredibly romantic win if he were to compete at least at the Open Championship. So I think everyone would love to see Tommy do it. Who else? I think, again, coming off a runner-up finish at the most recent major, Bob McIntyre is another one who is games tailor-made for Lynx Golf and will be chomping at the bit to get there. Obviously, defending his title in Scotland, and he'll be pulled left, right and centre, and there'll be so many demands on him as the returning champion next week at Renaissance. But then once he gets that out of the way, I think being back at Port Rush, where he also played very well 6 years ago, and he's a far better golfer, obviously, now than he was then, I think he might be one that could perhaps provide a home winner as well. So we always want to see the British guys do well. It's been far too long since we had a British winner of the Open Championship, a European winner of the Open Championship. You know, we haven't had, it's been the longest major since the last European win since Shane 6 years ago. So we'd love to see a European winner this time. That's no offense to you guys over there on that side of the pond. You know, I love you all dearly.
Well, very good transition, because I can't believe we've gone almost 20 minutes and haven't asked you a Ryder Cup question. So I'll go ahead and get at it. Can Keegan Bradley do both, play and captain? Go.
I do not believe he can in this day and age. No, I'm sure he will tell you differently. I found it startling that after his win at the Travelers, he came out in that press conference and revealed the fact that Seth Wall called him up and said, "We want you to do both." That's the first time I've heard him admit that. And I was like, really? Why? Because I just don't think in this day and age it is possible to do both. I think there's so many demands on you as a captain. There's so many things that you need to, A, have in place beforehand, which you can still do, I suppose. But B, you need to be thinking on the hoof. If plan A isn't working, you need to have a plan B, C, and D ready to go. And the captain needs to make calls. And the captain might be out in the golf course playing Rory McIlroy at the time. You know, it's. I think it's very difficult in this day and age. In fact, I think it's impossible in this day and age. But he is clearly one of the best 12 American golfers. That is unquestionable. Whether he still will be come September, who knows? And I think he's in this situation now where, you know, his duty as a captain is to assemble the best 12 players. So he has to. He's letting his team down if he doesn't pick himself. It's a very confusing situation. I don't really know how they've got into this situation, but the one man who will be smiling from ear to ear is the man who has been in his role for 3 years straight and has all his ducks in a row and has his backroom team assembled. And he's probably going to have a pretty much very similar looking team to how he did in Rome, and that's Luke Donald. So, yeah, perhaps it's just what the US need. Conversely as well, perhaps, you know, having this left field choice and having this captain who is such a sort of talismanic figure who pumps his chest and wears that red, white and blue and who it means so much to, it is exactly what they need out on the course as well. It's fascinating to see how this whole thing plays out. But I was quite astounded, and I don't know if you two were as well, when he admitted in that press conference after the Travelers that, oh yeah, no, this was actually the plan all along. This is what Seth and the PGA of America wanted all along. I found that extraordinary.
It certainly was. Last question for you, Jamie. Go ahead. Fly the flag. How do you think Luke Donald's squad is looking for Bethpage Black?
I think it's looking pretty good. I mean, as I said, I think it's going to be a fairly unchanged team from Rome. And certainly, you know, that top 10 is looking very settled. And, you know, some players who have had great success this season, but are just experienced stalwarts now. And, you know, I think, you know, Luke will have walked away from Rome 2 years ago knowing that the likes of Rory McIlroy and John Rahm and Tyrrell Hatton and Tommy Fleetwood and Shane Lowry weren't going anywhere. I think when you then have somebody like Sepp Straka elevate his game to another level and become a truly world-class player, that's something that he probably couldn't have foreseen leaving Rome 2 years ago. So that's a great thing to have. On the flip side of that, you've got somebody like Matt Fitzpatrick, who is a major champion, but, you know, was at the height of his powers 2 years ago, who his form hasn't been quite there this season. There were a few little green shoots in Detroit last week, so hopefully Fitz can get back to the kind of player that we know he is, because you're going to need that experience for that unbelievably boisterous bear pit of Bethpage, because I think it's very difficult to throw a rookie into a Ryder Cup like this one. So, you know, hopefully if players like that, if Justin Rose can find a bit more form, that's the kind of experience I think that will be really important to the side as well. There will be probably one or two rookies in there. Victor Hovland coming back to a bit of form. Ludvig Åberg, question marks over his form at the moment. But Ludvig is kind of that generational talent where I'm sure by September, and once he pulls on that blue shirt, he will be able to find something. But on the whole, I think this is the best placed European team to win on US soil for a long time. I was going to say since 2004, because 2012 was just that lightning in a bottle, you know, freak occurrence, Medina. That doesn't happen normally. So I think this will probably be the best prepared side since Langer came over in 2004 and emphatically won that Ryder Cup. And, you know, we've spoken loads about the crowd, and we will continue to speak about the crowd. I spoke to Billy Horschel about this a few months ago, And Billy said to me, and I love the way he said this, and it sort of stuck with me ever since. Yeah, you know, that crowd will be pretty rowdy, but New Yorkers will eat their own. So if Europe does manage to get up, if we do manage to get a bit of blue on the board early on, those New Yorkers will turn on the American team. And I think that is probably what Luke Donald and the Europeans will be hoping to do, to silence them early on, and then for a few of the boos to be targeted towards the American players. So it's going to be an incredible week. I can't wait for it. And I think the European team is looking pretty good at the moment. I certainly think there are far many more question marks over the US team than there are of the European team.
It's certainly torturous that we have to wait 2.5 more months before we get the Bethpage back. Fortunately, Jamie, we have the Scottish Open to look forward to, and certainly the year's final major, the Open Championship, a home game for you as well at Royal Portrush. You're one of our favorites. Look forward to seeing you next week and over the next couple of weeks. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Not at all, guys. Lovely to speak to you as always.
All right, Rex, let's finish this podcast with a couple of punch shots. Keegan Bradley rounded out his fifth and final vice captain for the U.S. Ryder Cup team. It's Gary Woodland who gets a nod, joining Jim Furyk, Brant Snedeker, Kevin Kisner, and Webb Simpson. Smart move by Captain Keegs?
I think so. Gary's respected in the team room. He's respected as a player. He's still very much an active player, so he'd be able to add a lot to those conversations about who would you would pair him with. And also the health issues I think Gary has gone through. Everyone respects what he has done, what he's overcome, how he continues to play, how he continues to be on the PGA Tour. And given the fact that Keegan Bradley seems to be trending more and more towards a player than a captain, I think all of the vice captains will have a louder voice.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting choice. On sort of my short list of favorites, I don't think I would have put him there. I think I would have put Ricky Fowler and Matt Kuchar sort of ahead of him. But then actually when I thought about it, I think it's a really wise choice by Keegan Bradley. He's still in his early 40s, is Gary Woodland. He's a beloved player. A lot of South Florida ties, which is obviously the majority of what this U.S. Ryder Cup team is going to be. Although he has been on only one U.S. team previously, that was a 2019 President's Cup, the one that traveled to Australia with playing captain Tiger Woods. I mean, the guy absolutely bleeds red, white, and blue. And let's be honest here, Jim Furyk and Brant Snedeker, sort of regardless of what Keegan Bradley ends up doing as a potential playing captain, they're going to be doing the heavy lifting. This is an opportunity for Gary Woodland to sort of plug some holes. And I foresee him doing so quite well. All right, the PGA Tour, Rex, announced last week that instead of $25 million going to the winner of the FedEx Cup, it will instead distribute that bonus pool in three different waves. You like this from PGA Tour HQ?
I don't know that I like it, but they had to do it. When they changed essentially the tour championship format away from starting strokes, which would have been largely panned, and I don't think anybody quite understood it. Certainly Scottie Scheffler was not a big fan of it. But what you did when you fixed that particular problem, you created the new problem that you had three playoff events. And the idea was you want to reward season-long performance, which was what the Comcast Top 10 is, and that's through the Wyndham Championship. And then you wanted to transition to whatever the playoffs were. Well, now you've sort of taken that away because it really doesn't matter how well you play. If you're Scottie Scheffler and you don't play well in the first two playoff events and you show up at East Lake, you still have the exact same chance as everyone else. So you sort of had to even that out. So they've created essentially three benchmarks. After the Wyndham Championship, there will be a payout using a portion of that FedEx Cup bonus pool. After the BMW Championship, which is the second playoff event, there will be another payout. And then, of course, how you perform at East Lake. I think it's the fairest and most equitable way. I'm not quite sure if this is going to stick, simply because players are going to start looking at the numbers very, very closely when it comes to these types of things. And I think a Scottie Scheffler, for example, he wouldn't be the one, would probably not be crazy happy if he ended up dominating the entire regular season like he has done and then somehow got to East Lake and finished dead last.
Now, the counter to that, though, Rex, would be that if you look back at what happened in 2023 with Jon Rahm, right, he was number one heading into the FedEx Cup playoffs. He was number one after the first playoff event, dropped to fourth after the BMW, and then he had a terrible week at East Lake, ended up finishing 18th when he was, at least statistically, according to the PGA Tour, the best player that season. And so instead of missing out on potentially tens of millions of dollars, I feel like this is a better way to reward those players monetarily. Mm-hmm. With $10 million after the Wyndham Championship. That doesn't even include the Wyndham rewards for the business top 10. So he'd also be getting the Comcast bonus as well. Again, Scottie Scheffler has already earned $16 million this season. Fans don't care about how much money you earn. They just want a compelling format and a season finale that actually feels fitting. I'm fine with it. I think it's a better system. All right, listener questions. How about this one from our friend Joseph Boza? Did the PGA of America pick the right captain in Keegan Bradley?
I don't know. That's the beauty of captains at Ryder Cups and President's Cup. It's always about hindsight. And we're the ones that benefit from that because we're the ones that get to decide after the fact if they were good captains or not. To be fair, I don't know how many times I felt like Tom Lehman is the example I always go back to as a U.S. captain. I felt like he was going to be a brilliant U.S. captain, and that U.S. team just got ran off the golf course. Now, it was a weird team. If you go back and look at some of the players who were on there, you wouldn't necessarily equate them to being U.S. Ryder Cup players. I think the PGA of America wanted to go in a new direction. And I think what they tried to use is the passion of Keegan Bradley, his connection to the Northeast, with it being a Bethpage Black, all of those things they were trying to capitalize on. Whether he's going to be a good captain, we don't know. We know that Luke Donald is a good captain. Where this thing gets complicated, and I keep coming back to that, is now you're in a situation where he very likely is going to be a playing captain. And suddenly you're going to have to come up with an entirely new scenario, an entirely new logistics. That's going to make it difficult.
Yeah, I like the pick at the time because I'm a believer that you don't need to be deeply experienced in order to lead and be a good leader of men. It certainly did come with a risk, and I think the PGA of America is realizing that now. I thought that Keegan Bradley would drop off in form. He has not done so, and now at this point, you have a conundrum. I know you wanted to get to this one, Rex. What is your unofficial Mount Rushmore of American pies after July 4th?
First and foremost, very unpopular opinion, pumpkin pie is gross. I hate it. It doesn't taste good. It's mushy. It's not something that I ever eat, even in Thanksgiving. And I did mine in order. So 4, pecan pie or pecan pie, depending if you're in Georgia, which you are right now. 3, cherry pie. Love cherry pie. 2, this is going to be a bit controversial, I know. Chocolate pie. So good. Whipped cream on top. And then number 1, ba-bam, apple pie. Come on. 4th of July was last week.
Has to be spiced apple pie. Otherwise, I don't want it. And that is my official ranking, the Mount Rushmore of American pies. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Rex and I'll be back on Wednesday for a full preview of the Genesis Scottish Open. Rex will be the central reporter. Make sure you're on the lookout for that. In the meantime, you guys know the drill. NBCSports.com/golf for all Lay's news, notes, and updates. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days.